As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Euro qualifiers assemble. We definitely talk about some fixtures you could watch if you won. We also look at England-Australia's down through history, examine Leo Messi's MLS successes, talk Wayne Rooney getting the Washington Bullet, and salute Eden Hazard and a place in posterity as big as his posterior. It's the Totally Football Show. Thursday, the 12th of October. Very big hello to you, listener. Today's Totally features Duncan Alexander. All right, Duncan.
Hello, James.
Also, Adrian Clark here. All right, Adrian.
Hello.
Hello to you. We've got Dom Fifield remotely.
Hello, James.
Hi, Dom. Lovely to see you.
And you.
We don't see much of you anymore because you've become a big cheese upstairs.
I'm anything but a big cheese.
Really?
Never been a big cheese fan, me.
All right. What? Because you don't report anymore. You commission.
Yeah.
What have you commissioned to fill the yawning hole of the international weekend?
Well, various things from various club writers. Nothing huge that will impinge upon Totally, I suspect.
Okay. But, all right. You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. Duncan, you're also now very much in the big cheese upstairs department.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Yeah, Duncan's an editor.
Is he?
Bree here now. Yeah, me and Dom chat about ideas.
Do you squabble over writers,
Everyone has their own assigned people.
You've got Michael Cox. Well,
sometimes I do actually come and steal some of Duncan's writers.
Is that right?
Sometimes illegally, actually.
You do, yeah. Yeah, actually, scratch everything I just said. Dom's a sneaky rat.
I love this. Inside at all. How about you, listener? It's lovely to have you on, Dom. And we got so much to talk about, you'd be amazed to hear. Adrian, you're off on holiday tomorrow.
I am, yeah, a little surprise one. I didn't know about it until last week.
I can't believe you're going away at this moment of the season.
Yeah, there's so much going on, isn't there?
So much going on. For example, this evening, Thursday, as we record, well, it's Thursday pretty much everywhere, but it's this evening as we record, the First Nations could see the first teams to book their spots at next summer's Euro Jamboree. It could be Scotland in Group A, with then Norway and Spain facing each other on Sunday. Potentially, those teams battling for the other place from that group. France could also be qualified. They're going to be facing Netherlands on Friday. England are all but sorted. They lead Italy and Ukraine by 6 points in Group C. Italy face Malta on Saturday. A little bit nervous. Italy ahead of their clash then with England. I think next Tuesday, isn't it? Tuesday. Mm. All sorts of other stuff going on. Turkey take on their main Group D rivals, Croatia. That's Wales' group, of course. Turkey will be having their brand new coach debuting. It's Vincenzo Montella. How about that? Oh, in Group F, you've got the top two teams facing each other. They're both on 13 points from a possible 15. Who are these incredible footballing nations? Ralf Rangnick's Austria and Domenico Tedesco's Belgium, who, of course, sport the Euro 2024 qualifying top scorer, Romelu Lukaku. 8-5, Adrian, 8-5.
I know. I was looking at the top scorer list. It's Manchester United heavy.
Is it?
Yeah. Mm. McTominay is second.
Oh, yeah.
Hoyland, I think, is up there as well. And Bruno Fernandes isn't far away either. So, yeah, it's United might be sort of rubbish domestically, but their players, you know, current and former, are flying in on the international scene.
Okay, I was going to ask for a game that you're looking forward to this weekend, but in your case, it's probably ping pong at the hotel. Sports.
Pretty much, yeah. Oh, just flying down the flumes, having races down the old slides.
Nice. Yeah. Okay, Duncan, how about you? Have you earmarked an international?
I was, believe it or not, I was quite interested in Wales-Gibraltar last night.
Yeah.
Because it was Wales mixed their team up. I played at the Racecourse Ground for the first time. In a while. I wonder what brought that stadium back to prominence. I don't know. But for me...
Oldest international venue for football in the world, huh?
And for me, it was the first time ever that two Wigan players have faced each other in an international. TJ Debar up front for Gibraltar and sensational defender Joe Lowe making his full debut for Wales.
So all right.
That was a nice little, little moment.
Joe Lowe playing in a low block. And equally, did Debar hit Debar?
Debar didn't hit Debar this time, although I have seen that happen, and it's very enjoyable to say that repeatedly. But yeah, so that was nice.
All right.
Yeah. Charlie Savage, son of Rob.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, son of Robbie. He starred in the game, apparently.
It was a 4-0 win. Well, Duncan, you saw it. What did you think of Charlie Savage?
Yeah, played well. I mean, yeah, and a good prospect. I mean, it does fit with my theory. I said this to Dom, actually, in the week, that there does feel to be a higher proportion of ex-footballers' sons playing these days. Mm. Like, every team seems to have three or four. So,
Dom, is there a game that you will be making an effort to watch, possibly successfully?
I'll try and watch Spain-Scotland tonight, because I'm just full of admiration for everything that Steve Clarke's done with the Scots. And if they secure qualification with a point in Seville, that's quite the achievement.
Mm. Yeah, my son's going to that game.
Oh, yeah?
My eldest. Yeah, he's currently on holiday with his girlfriend. I think they're in a camper van. And yeah, he just dropped it in last night on text. Yeah, going to watch Spain v Scotland. So I was like, who are you following? Who are you supporting? He's like, obviously Spain.
Is that right?
Yeah.
They're holding it in the Seville's third stadium. Yeah.
It's still quite a big ground, isn't it? I remember seeing it at the Euros. So yeah, I've warned him that there might be a lot of Scottish people around. I suspect there will be. I mean, it's a huge, huge night, isn't it, for him?
It is. It is. You've also got Denmark, Kazakhstan. That group's mad. I'm not sure if you're across Group H, but you've got Denmark and Kazakhstan and Slovakia and Finland, they're all separated by just 1 point, and they're all facing each other on Saturday. That's going to be huge. Netherlands, France is a big one. That's Friday evening. And, France won the reverse fixture 4-0. Why is it so big? Well, Netherlands are not entirely secure of being in the top two because Greece are creeping up behind them. You know what? On Monday's show, which will be up slightly later so we can get in the Sunday night results, we'll be reviewing all of the weekend's qualifying action. By the way, the next Euros has now been confirmed. It's going to be in UK and Ireland. Are you excited about that?
Very. Yeah, very excited.
Although it looks like the home nations involved. How many, Duncan?
Five.
Good Lord.
The IFAB lads plus Ireland.
Plus Ireland. They'll all still have to qualify.
Although there's talk there'll be two reserve spots left open in case any fail. Like, come on, you can come in.
Right.
Except for Northern Ireland and Republic of Ireland. it's a bit of a low blow, wasn't it?
Adrian. All right. And then the Euros after that, Adrian, Italy and Turkey.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, it's the thing now, isn't it? You don't just send these major tournaments to one nation.
Apparently.
We sort of spread the love, don't we? But, yeah, it's good to know in advance, isn't it?
It is.
But, yeah, no, it'd be great to have a major tournament back on these shores. Let's hope that
they sell out the tickets, because the thing no one ever mentions about Euro 96 was that other than the England games at Wembley, most of the games were half full. Wagging my finger at
the other point is, of course, what happened the last time a major final happened at Wembley. So there were too many people that wanted to go to the game, and it went wrong. So in that sense, it's a slight surprise that we have been awarded it. But yeah, it'd be great.
Okay. Did you have a special Spain stat?
I do, yeah.
Before they play Scotland?
Yeah, it's not great news potentially for Scotland, who only need a point, don't they, to guarantee their qualification. At home in Euros qualifiers, the last time Spain failed to win was June 2003.
Okay.
Since then, they've played 24, won 24, and the goal difference across the last 10 matches is 37-1.
So their goals for is 37, and they've conceded one goal in 10 years. No, in 10 matches.
In the last 10 matches at home in the Euros qualifiers. So they're quite good.
But did Scott McTominay play in any of those games?
He didn't.
He didn't. One other game that we should be getting very excited about is, of course, England-Australia.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
England-Australia. Woo! It's a friendly. It's at Wembley on Friday night. Who remembers the last time these sides met?
Sterling Ingham got plenty of pace. Oh, my goodness. Marcus Rashford. Inside 2.5 minutes. The dream continues for the teenager.
Yeah, the 2-1 win. Marcus Rashford's debut, scoring after 138 seconds, I think, as an England player. The youngest ever scorer on debut for England. But a 2-1 win, which filled us all with such huge optimism going in Euro 2016, which went so well.
It was Roy Hodgson's England. And whose Australia was it, Dom?
Cool, there's a question. No idea.
Ange Postecoglou.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. That was the pre-Euro 2016 friendly. Ooh, Duncan.
That era, it's hard to remember some of the competitive games, let alone the build-up friendlies. But conversely, the 2003 game I remember really well.
What a game.
Quite an unusual match all round. Upton Park.
Yeah. It was at Upton Park. Is that the only international ever staged there?
There's not many.
Mm. It was the first time England had played there.
Unusual, yeah.
And I can't recall it happening again.
It might have had like a, you know, random friendly that sometimes countries arrange
Brazil.
In. Yeah, like Jamaica have played at Loftus Road and stuff. So, but yeah, it was peak Sven-Göran Eriksson era. It was Wayne Rooney's debut. It was the classic 11 substitutions at halftime, which people always used to enjoy. As you were like, what? Who's that?
Isn't that better, though, than having the second half punctuated by all these stoppages? I quite like it.
Hmm.
Seriously.
I don't know. It used to wind people up a lot of the time.
Like, I mean,
so much so that FIFA banned it.
Yeah, it's giving caps away, isn't it? Which sort of goes against the honour of representing the country.
But bit harsh from Franny Jeffers, but yeah.
It is. It does make it a game of two halves in a very real sense. Both teams went for 11 substitutions at halftime.
Just England.
Who were 2-0 down at the break anyway, against what was largely peak Australia.
Really good Australian team. Really good players in there.
But my lasting memory of that day, evening, night even, was I'd been working and walking back through London, and every pub in central London was just, Australians were spilling out in high spirits. Understandably, they'd just beaten England at football.
Everton helps it on to Eloisi. England could be stretched here. Eloisi, Everton, that's it. Everton signals success for Australia.
3-1 was the final score. England's goal coming as the result of a nice move, actually, of three of the second-half debutants. Jermaine Genus, Wayne Rooney, who kind of chested the ball on, and then Franny Jeffers, who did the scoring and became, by virtue of that, one of an exclusive club of England players who have only played once for the Three Lions but scored in that game. In the last 40 years, we could only find three other examples. Here's a bit of international weekend fun for you, Adrian. Can you name any
Dave
of those?
Dave Nugent is one of them,
yes.
Isn't he? Yeah. I saw him the other day.
Did you? What was he doing?
I saw him at Leicester.
Was he stealing goals of anyone
else? He was doing local radio, but... Yeah, he's quite a jovial, sort of smiley character. I liked him. Yeah.
You would be if you'd scored for England from 15 centimetres and then, you know.
Yeah, I do remember that goal. Yeah.
Two others. Stephen Corker. Yeah?
Sierra Leone, Stephen Corker.
Okay.
I was speaking to him only this morning.
Really? What was he doing?
Stephen has just set up an academy for players who have been released from Premier League clubs. And it's an amazing, amazing project. He's free agent at the moment. He's looking for a club, I think. But we ran a piece on him in the week. Jay Harris wrote a very good piece, which I would recommend all Athletic subscribers have a look at.
Is Jay one of yours, Dom?
No, he's not actually, but he should be.
Okay.
I've got my eye on him. He'll be mine soon.
Duncan, were you talking to Danny Wallace at all this week?
Sadly not.
Okay, because he was the other one.
Yeah.
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 Mm. All right, what about this time when England take on Australia? How are England doing? Dom, last time out in the qualifiers, we saw the perfect record so far in this campaign, spoiled by that 1-1 draw against Ukraine. And then we had the 3-1 away to Scotland in the friendly. What's your take on how England are?
Look, I think they're doing what they do between every tournament pretty much at the moment. They were a bit disappointing against Ukraine, but then they turned it on at Scotland, at Hampden Park, and you know, where everybody expected them to be really tested by a resurgent Scottish team. So we know they've got the quality. It'll always come down to which players are available for which fixtures. I can see Southgate almost fielding a second team against Australia. I think he'll maybe a few of the senior players that he usually relies upon will get a run out, but it's very much geared towards Tuesday's game against Italy. So maybe we'll see some fresh, some new faces, relatively new faces, because there aren't that many new faces in this squad, really. So
Eddie Nketiah, who else is there that's new?
Well, we might see Levi Colwill, I guess, possibly as a left-back, even against... I mean, he's been playing left-back for Chelsea. It's not his natural position, but he can do a job there. But, I mean, I do wonder whether we see Trent Alexander in midfield. I mean, that seems to be where Gareth Southgate wants to play him now, but whether he gets into the first choice midfield for next week is presumably doubtful.
Funnily enough, John Sands writes in. Hello, John. He says, do the pundits have a view on what England's best midfield three look like? Is it Bellingham, Rice, Trent, given that Southgate appears to see the likes of Foden and Maddison as forwards rather than midfielders?
I don't actually put Trent Alexander-Arnold in my first choice England side.
Okay.
I love him. I love his right foot. It's a weapon, isn't it? Blimey. But he's a rookie in that position, and I think I'd like to see a bigger sample size of him playing in that role, really. Do you know what I would like to see? I'd like to see Stones and Rice play at the base of a midfield. Mm. But, you know, Man City style. Obviously, Stones alongside Rodri helped them win the treble last year, and I think that is something that could work for England, especially if you had a back three behind, where Stones could potentially just drop back in when we were under a little bit of pressure. And then if you had those two, you could then have Bellingham a little bit higher, maybe with a Foden or a Maddison. I was having a little play around with it yesterday. 3-2-4-1, like Man City did last year. Stones and Rice, and then you've probably got, obviously not for this game, but Saka, Bellingham, Foden or Maddison, and then probably Rashford, but maybe Grealish on the left. I like that. What are you laughing at, James?
No, I'm laughing at Duncan's face.
What? Well, you'll play around with England teams. You're never too old for that, are you?
No, it wasn't that. Duncan.
Yeah, I mean, to Adrian's point, I think this season's been interesting in the sense that obviously Madison's gone to Spurs and is really thriving as a 10. Bellingham's playing a lot further forward for Real Madrid than we probably thought he would do. And I think that has created essentially an option for Southgate to use those two players in that position, obviously choose one. But we also know that Gareth Southgate doesn't really...
He won't do it. No.
So, yeah, I think given how Southgate is, Trent playing in that position is probably as inventive as he might get. So on that basis, I would encourage it.
Okay. Is there anything you're particularly, or anyone you're particularly excited to see?
Ollie Watkins, I think, you know, has been playing brilliantly recently. Not just his goals, but his kind of off the ball running, his pressing has been amazing. And, you know, he's definitely earned his recall. And you'd hope that he'd get at least the Australia game to, you know, because we don't really have a proper understudy for Harry Kane. So, yeah, that's what I hope for.
Mm. All right. Dom?
I think a front three of Watkins, maybe Rashford on the left, and Jared Bowen up there as well. I mean, we'd love to see Bowen play. He's playing superbly for West Ham, earned his own recall. So, yeah, as long as Watkins and Bowen get a run out in the Australia game and hope to impress ahead of Italy. But I do think that Southgate will be targeting Italy and then almost working backwards as to which players he selects for the friendly.
And surely, Dom, you would be keen to see Sam Johnstone get the Palace hero.
Well, you know, no other goalkeepers kept more clean sheets in the Premier League this season, so why not? It won't be him, though, will it?
I don't think so. Well, I thought Ramsdale. I mean, what a funny time it's been for Aaron Ramsdale. Played in that Scotland game. I thought he was excellent. Mm. It was a superb team performance, full stop, actually. I was very, very impressed with England that night. But I thought he looked super confident, and we've seen him once since, you know, in that Brentford League Cup game. So, but yeah, I would like to see Cole Will start. I would also like to see Lewis Dunk given another opportunity. I thought he was fantastic at Hampden. And I just think he's the way he is on the ball is just so suited to international football. He's turned into a brilliant passer, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He never was.
And also, he made a mistake in Brighton's game at Marseille the other week, but it didn't let it affect him. He then became one of the best players of the night. Yeah, so
I think him at the heart of that defence could be something that works moving forward. One thing that we've got an issue with at the moment is down the left. Mm. There are no fit left backs. I mean, Shaw's out, isn't he? Chilwell's out. Rico Henry, who might have had a shout, is out for the season. So we're kind of left with Colwell. And then you think about the left wingers, Rashford out of form and Jack Grealish out of the team. He's been injured, but he can't get back. I think a lot of people thought that Pep Guardiola would put him straight back into the City team, but he hasn't really featured. And he was an unused sub at Emirates, which I thought was a little bit of a snub, considering that he made a few second half changes, Pep. So yeah, he'll be desperate to play and to shine.
Okay. England taking on Australia on Friday. After that, as mentioned, it's Italy. Australia, post the England game, have a clash with New Zealand for the Ashes. Now, the other day we were asking why this football clash is called the Ashes. Thanks, Ryan Melville, for putting our minds at rest. The Ashes in the trophy for Australia against New Zealand were from cigars smoked by the captains back in 1923 and collected in a razor tin that had travelled with an Anzac soldier when he fought at Gallipoli. Woo! Trophy was subsequently lost until it turned up, no doubt there was a small white dog involved, in a garage this year. That's a lovely story, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Was it donated or sold?
What?
Back to the Federation.
I imagine it was handed over swiftly by some right-thinking citizen. Mm. Anyway, all right. Well, that's... anything else you want to say about England against Australia? No? Okay.
I think the Italy game is more interesting, but you'll get to that in the next pod, won't you?
I guess we will. Next up then, everyone's doing their Eden Hazard bit. Let's do ours.
Football is bigger and more complicated than ever before. Just ask VAR.
Check complete. It's fine. Perfect. Yeah.
So the Daily Football Briefing is here to help, whether it's the World Cup.
It's a kind of face-saving. Everyone's happy. No one's a loser.
Lionel Messi.
As they say, he completed football.
Or Manchester United.
I mean, the performances all season have been questionable.
That are making you quizzical. The Daily Football Briefing has all the answers you need for every football story that matters, and it does exactly what the name suggests. It's daily, it's brief, and it's all about football. The Daily Football Briefing from The Athletic, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Hazard's got some space here. And off he goes, through the gears, through the glass, into the net. Genius. There's no other word to describe it. He's the best around.
All right, if you fancy some red hot Eden Hazard chat, and I know I do, then have a listen to the Athletic Football Podcast, which was out on Wednesday, featuring actual Belgian Christophe Tourreur, who's a lovely chap. And they spent the whole show, I think, talking about Eden Hazard, so woof. But we're going to do a little bit now, just because it's not every week that a legend calls time on his career. What would be your Hazard Hall of Fame moment, Dominic Fifield, who saw him so often there for the Blues?
Well, I mean, there were so many. That was the thing. I was lucky enough to interview him 3 times. He was always good fun, very honest in those interviews. He was just a wonderful player to watch, a player that played with a smile on his face you know, cheeky, knew he had the beating of any player he came up against, really. Very low centre of gravity, very quick turning and just sort of scuttling around the pitch and scored some absolutely breathtaking goals over his 7 years at Chelsea. I mean, some of those. I mean, the West Ham, the goal he scored against West Ham, the goal he scored against Arsenal, sorry, Adrian. Mm. Absolutely incredible.
Was that the one
incredible.
Where he knocked Coquelin over?
Yeah, exactly. Amazing. Yeah. Goes past, spins
away from
Coquelin.
The West Ham one's amazing. I'd say that having just watched Eden Hazard's top 10 goals in that West Ham one, where he basically shimmies through past five defenders and then puts it past the keeper.
He couldn't get the ball off him, could he? It was just glued to his instep.
Yeah.
And the ones he scored against Liverpool.
He almost invites
him.
The challenge to kind of bounce off it again with ball still in his possession. The Spurs one as well in the game, which I think decided the title in 2016 for Leicester. That was a bit special.
Away from Alderweireld, Diego Costa, Eden Hazard! Glorious goal! Leicester's goal!
The context of that one being that he'd had his worst season at Chelsea and really struggled. Obviously, Chelsea had a nightmare. Mourinho had been sacked in December. And yet he still, in the moment, the one remaining moment to sort of redeem that season for Chelsea fans, i.e. prevent Tottenham winning the league, he pulled out a brilliant goal like that. But he was a complete joy. I mean, the state of his ankles were quite something. And I suppose we should have seen maybe the toils that he endured at Madrid in advance. But I think he had 638 fouls against him in his time at Chelsea, 7 years. That's one every 26 touches he earned a foul. And he'd come off the pitch with his ankle, with his socks ripped to shreds, and you know, the cuts and the bruises on his ankles in particular, because that was where the point of contact generally was. So it's maybe not a surprise that he's had serious ankle problems at Madrid, amongst other things, and his career never really took off there. I mean, Mourinho warned us about this. It was New Year's Day 2015. He said, you know, unless he gets better protection, his career may well be cut short, and so it's proved.
Yeah, the numbers in Spain are remarkable. Possibly, I mean, it was one of the worst transfers from Real Madrid's point of view of all time. They paid almost 80 million euros for him. He spent 4 years there, 76 appearances in those 4 years, only completed 90 minutes in six of those games, only scored seven goals, and in four seasons in Spain, never played a single minute against Barcelona, which is just incredible.
I mean, it's rare you get a point in a player's career where it's such a turning point. Hazard played over 30 games in every Premier League season he was at Chelsea. You know, he was in... Dom's right, he got targeted, but he kept bouncing back and playing on. And then he obviously famously put on a bit of weight that summer before,
right,
when he went to Madrid. And, you know, I kind of... Michael Cox has pointed this out as well, is that Hazard is a bit of a sort of throwback footballer. He didn't really care about the celebrity, just liked playing football. But football wasn't like the be-all and end-all. He's almost like the only modern version of those sort of 70s Stan Bowles sort of players that just love playing football and were really good. And then, you know, he doesn't seem particularly gutted that his career's over at 32. He's probably just gone, well, I had a really good time at Chelsea and, you know, I'm one of the greats of my era.
And he did, didn't he? I mean, I think prime Eden Hazard was... It was really second only to Lionel Messi in terms of watchability and talent. I mean, I loved it because I used to be a winger. I just loved watching, you know, I've never really taken to Chelsea as a club, but I used to love watching Chelsea when he played for them because of those mesmeric dribbles, the way he chopped the ball from the left foot to the right or vice versa to skip around defenders was just so much fun. He just got kicked too much. I think Dom hit the nail on the head. I think there was one challenge. Is it Meunier, I think, that really crunched him, and he never seemed to... He was out for a while after that and never seemed to really recover. And I think when injuries bite and you spend a lot of time on the treatment table, the problem is you're always chasing it, and then it's easier to pick up other injuries following that. And that was his first big one. And from there on, it was like a chain of events. And because you... And I experienced this myself when I had a long period of out. When you're out injured... you discover a little bit more of life outside of football. And I think maybe with Eden Hazard, the hunger just waned.
He wasn't called, did it?
Yeah.
He wasn't called Eden Hazard for nothing.
I mean, yeah, the hunger maybe affected him in a different way.
The weight at pre-season was, I think, always part of the issues that he had with Real Madrid. The other one was when he chuckled with his former Chelsea teammates after they knocked Real out in the Champions League.
But also, I think the emergence of young players in his position worked against him. Vinicius Junior, for example, Rodrigo, they came through at the time when he was out injured a lot, and they were brilliant. And obviously the need for Real Madrid to then bring him back into the side diminished. So, yeah, it was sort of a lot of factors behind his fairly rapid demise. But he had a great career.
He made Lille double winners in France. That's extraordinary.
And everyone's peak is at different times. And his peak just happened to be in his early 20s, you know, up until the sort of mid to late 20s. And then nothing really after.
Yeah, and we've kind of been spoiled in longevity stakes by Messi and Ronaldo have been so good for so long. And that isn't normal. I mean, Hazard's length of career at the top is kind of right. And just to put some numbers on it, he one of only four players in Premier League history to score 15 or more in a season and assist 15 or more in that same season. And the other three are Henri, Letizia and Eric Cantona way back when. So in modern terms, he's unrivaled.
Did you just wince when you said Letizia?
No.
We haven't talked about one thing, and it's his bum. Carl Anker wrote a whole piece about this.
Did he?
Yeah, he did. Well, he quotes Yaya Toure, who wrote in 2021, when the ball arrives at Hazard, he can already sense the opponent coming towards him, so he waits until the last moment and uses his bum to block them. It pushes the opponent away, almost like a punch. And then when he has opened up that space between him and the defender, he will power away and start the attack. I mean, his bum is significant.
Yeah, if you've got a weapon like that, then use it, right?
Mm.
I mean, it was a strong derriere.
He also did a lot of judo as a kid.
Did he?
Helped him learn how to fall, so that when he was fouled or taken out in games, he didn't land awkwardly.
I wonder too, Dom, having done a little bit of jiu-jitsu myself, whether it facilitated that knack he seemed to have of using an opponent's oncoming force and just deflecting
spin away.
It away.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
But he was terrified of eagles.
Was he?
Who isn't?
The first
manifest?
Game he played at Selhurst Park would have been the early spring of 2014. He was the last Chelsea player to come out of the tunnel. And at the time, Palace had Kayla the Eagle that used to fly from one crossbar down to the other end. And it started off at the Holmesdale. And he was doing what he does, skipping onto the pitch, looking very cheerful. And then you could watch him. You could see this shadow going across the turf and going over him. And he looked up and he was like, oh my God, what is that? And it was this huge Kayla the Eagle swooping down, must have been about 10 feet above his head, went down to the other end. And I spoke to him about it subsequently. And he said, yeah, it's not every day you look up and there's a bird of prey swooping down on you at a football stadium. But there you go.
I like to think Kayla and the Eagle and Pickles the dog are together now.
That's a lovely image.
I'd have flinched then, wouldn't you?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
definitely. Of course you would.
I wouldn't.
His bum wouldn't have protected him there if she'd got him in his talons.
Lovely image. And a great place to put a little full stop on that bit of our Eden Hazard chat. Best of luck to him, whatever he's up to next. What we're going to be doing in a minute or two is talking about another former attacking midfield great and what they're about to get up to, Wayne Rooney. Inbound at Birmingham.
Hello, listeners. This is Ian Stone, host of Handbrake Off, your dedicated Arsenal podcast from The Athletic. Myself and Amy Lawrence, Adrian Clark, Art DeRoche and James Maniculas are with you twice a week, every week throughout the season, as we bring you all the news and views from in and around the club. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to follow and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Sports Podcast Awards Soccer Podcast of the Year.
Hello, Sasu Heinu, who says, I'd like to hear Adrian's view on the players' workload nowadays. It's non-stop football, and it's only going to get worse. Is that right, Adrian?
I actually did a whole pod on this.
Did you?
So, yeah, go back and listen to the Athletic football podcast. It was really, really good, actually. It was a good sort of four-way chat. And do you know what? I probably sided the other way in terms of, let's blame... If we're going to blame anybody, let's blame the FIFA and UEFA for expanding all of their competitions.
Always a good call.
Exactly. I think the bottom line is footballers hate not playing. And if there's a game for them, they want to be in it.
They want to be in it. Mm. Richard David Pike wants to talk about Luxembourg. I'm not falling for that, Richard. We had a show recently where they talked up Luxembourg, who have a very significant chance of qualifying for their first ever international tournament. They just need to win away from home against Iceland, that's this Friday, and then home in their next match against Slovakia, and they'll be sort of sorted almost to make it through to Germany next summer. Amazing. Anyway, we talked up Luxembourg last time, and then they went and lost 9-0 to Portugal. But I will keep an eye on them, Richard. It's a great shout. Brian Doyle also writes, and he says, with Birmingham giving the job to Wayne Rooney, will they live to regret it? Brian's short on punctuation, I think, because of the urgency of his message. Will they live to regret it as they were in sixth and Rooney has had a 25% and 28% win percent? What do you think? Adrian, you've followed Birmingham City so far. First of all, what kind of a shock was it to you them deciding to dispatch poor John Eustace?
It wasn't a surprise because the rumours have been around ever since the new American owners came in. I think it was a pretty open secret. I don't think John Eustace was the least bit surprised. On the face of it, it was the harshest of dismissals because Birmingham are sixth.
They're sixth?
Yeah, and it's not very often that Birmingham City are in sixth.
A DC United sixth?
No. They struggled again this season. So, yeah, he was doing a very good job. They're a team on the up. They've recruited some decent players, and the players seem very, very content under his pretty sensible management. That said, I do know a few Birmingham City fans, and this ownership change has really altered their outlook. They now have stars in their eyes.
Oh,
they now believe that they're on a pathway, a trajectory towards, you know, the Premier League, I guess. And they did have reservations that Eustace was the man to take them there. Now, whether Wayne Rooney is an upgrade or not remains to be seen. I have to say, on the balance of win ratios and performances so far, you'd have to question it. You'd have to say that this appointment is a stars in their eyes appointment, as in it's Wayne Rooney. That's why we're going to go for him, because his record at Derby and under challenging circumstances and at DC United was modest, to say the least.
Do you remember when they were on the fringes of the playoff positions and they binned Gary Rout and brought in Gianfranco Zola?
Went well, didn't it? I think he departed within 24 games with an 8% win ratio.
8%.
Yeah. Right. I'm sure Wayne would do better than that. But yeah, look, who knows how he will do? But I have my reservations over his tactical nous. I think he's a good man motivator. He'll attract players. Players will want to come to Birmingham City and play for Wayne Rooney. He's obviously got Ashley Cole and John O'Shea as part of his backroom team. So I don't think they'll have a problem recruiting. It's the in-game management. How smart is he going to be?
Okay.
Moving forwards.
We'll talk to Paul Tenorio in a second or two with a view on how he managed in a not straightforward position at DC United and what the issues were there. Dom, the new setup though at Birmingham, are you familiar at all with how it works with Tom Brady and how active a role he has? It was a very eye-catching statement the club put out this week.
Yeah, I mean, they put out a few eye-catching statements. They suggested the other day that Birmingham City were basically the most newsworthy club on the planet and had got 17 billion positive media hits, whatever that means, on socials and etc., which is like pretty much over twice the population of the globe.
Well, I've certainly been hitting them a lot, but...
wonder where you've been. It's an exciting time, I guess. There's a lot to do at that club. I mean, in terms of the stadium and the team rebuild, etc. But I suppose you... clubs like that look at the championship and see it as an opportunity. It doesn't seem, I suppose it's a bit stronger than last year, Adrian, you'd probably be better in position to say, but I mean, it feels like a stronger championship with the teams got who were relegated at the end of last season. But I think they'll still target maybe the playoff place as a reasonable attainment. They could achieve that potentially if Rooney hits the ground running and makes a positive impact.
Yeah, they've got an outside chance of the playoffs. That's about the best they can do. They're not going to challenge for automatic promotion.
Do you think they have a worse chance under Rooney than they did before? That seemed to be what you were...
No, well, I'm not going to say that because I think give Wayne Rooney a chance.
Right.
He's actually going to have funds available to him. He never had that at Derby before where he had to
didn't
play
really
the kids.
Didn't really have it at DC either.
He didn't have it at DC. So, I'm more than happy to give Wayne Rooney a chance. Hmm. But I do feel that... the appointment is via his name rather than his credentials so far. But I wish him luck. Also, there is that factor of Gary Cook, who's the CEO at Birmingham City. He's very good friends with Wayne Rooney's agent. You know, long-standing relationship. It is quite a convenient appointment. But look, they've got grand ambitions. It's not just the football club and the team that they're looking to build either. I think they've got their eye on a new stadium. Obviously, I don't know if you've been to Birmingham lately. I live, you know, not too far away, but everywhere you look, new buildings are popping up. It is a city that is growing really, really fast. And I think that these owners want to be a big part of that and make Birmingham the hub of the country outside of London, of course. So,
woof.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so I think, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if they stick around long enough, if they build a new ground. And obviously, they've got their eyes on the Premier League. But for me, the team... is a massive long shot to reach the Premier League come the end of this season.
Quite a strange club, Birmingham, in the sense that they've got the record for most relegations from the top flight ever. So they've constantly, you know, they're very much a yo-yo team between the top two divisions for a long, long time. But like Adrian says, the potential is there. But just some of the statements, like they said in the statement when they got rid of Eustace, they said, we want to have a no-fear playing style, which just, what does that mean? Like was John Eustace coming out and just going, oh, we're really scared.
It was really quite classless, wasn't it?
Isn't that what Schalke have?
No fear, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought the initial statement was so crass and disrespectful to Eustace. It basically said that the manager didn't share the club's winning mentality. Mm. That's paraphrasing, but I thought that was... really, really harsh. It's great to have ambitions to be world class, to take things to the next level. But I think you have to also have a touch of realism and turning Birmingham City with the group of players they've got into some form of thrilling, entertaining, possession-based side that sweeps all before them.
Mm.
It's just not realistic. And I'm sure that John Eustace said that to them.
Right.
They didn't want to hear it. And now they've moved on from him. So it's going to be fascinating. Because the thing is, Wayne Rooney's teams haven't been that exciting. They've been quite pragmatic, maybe because he didn't have, you know, the ideal scenario around him. But he certainly isn't a coach that's known for thrilling attacking football.
All right.
Derby was very much a survival thing. To get 55 points that season wasn't that bad an achievement.
Well.
It was impressive, wasn't it?
I think it was
only minus 8 goal difference, 11 home wins. It was decent. It was only the 21 point deduction that did for them that year.
Liam Rossini was obviously, if you remember, they were sort of fighting over who was going to be the manager. Yeah.
But I still think that Liam had a big say in that coaching setup, even when Wayne was appointed as manager.
Mm. I think Liam Rossini might have been the tactical brains of that operation, personally.
Mm.
But yeah, so we'll see.
It all starts a week on Saturday at Middlesbrough, actually, where Wayne will be facing his former Manchester United teammate Michael Carrick across the benches. Interesting. Very good. All right, well, I mentioned that we're going to speak to Paul Tenorio for a stateside view on Wayne and also one or two other big issues. On stateside soccer of late, like Leo Messi, season ticket prices, that kind of thing. And that is up next.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
All right, Paul Tenorio of The Athletic now joins us to talk about Leo Messi and much, much more on the MLS front, including Wayne Rooney's departure from DC United with just a little bit left in the regular season.
Yes, just one big weekend of games left. There are a couple other teams that have games left to play, including Lionel Messi's Inter Miami, which is eliminated from playoff contention as well. But this has been an active year in Major League Soccer as far as managers being fired. And Rooney wasn't fired per se. It was a mutual decision to part ways. But I think it was the right one and it was an obvious one. This team wasn't really moving forward under Wayne Rooney. And really, I think DC United was in need of a complete and total makeover top to bottom in their sporting department. And Wayne Rooney might have alluded to that a little bit as he was leaving, saying, I've done everything I can do to try to get this team to the playoffs, and they haven't done that, and this is just the right time to move on and move forward. I am a bit surprised at how quickly Wayne Rooney landed a job, and a good job at that. I think it speaks to how much a name can help you. Obviously, Rooney and his accomplishments on the field, unquestioned, right? But what he's done as a manager, I think there are some question marks still there, and to take over a team that's been playing well so far this season, it puts pressure on him immediately.
What are the questions that DC United fans would have about Rooney's period there?
Well, again, I really didn't feel like the team made much progress in terms of kind of a distinct style of play. They certainly weren't considered one of the better football playing teams in the league. You can chalk that up to a number of reasons. As I said earlier, I think this is a sporting department and at DC United that needs to make some changes. The processes to find players weren't necessarily the best ones. They need a new general manager. They need to kind of create a method to finding players where a manager can say, this is the system I'm playing. This is the way I want players to excel in X, Y, and Z position. And I think, you know, as we saw with some of the player signings under Rooney, it felt like a manager saying, okay, well, I know this player and I know that player. Let's just go sign them. And for me, that typically doesn't lead to success. So I think the hope for Wayne Rooney now going back to England is that he's able to be more of just the manager and worry just about what the team is doing on the field, putting a system of play into place, creating an identity and trying to win. And it felt at DC that he never really got to that part of the job. And I think that ultimately hurt the team a lot in the results. And I think it spoke to the organization as much as just to Rooney. But, you know, I do think that there are questions still of like, what kind of manager is Wayne Rooney? What kind of football does he want his teams to play?
Questions that Birmingham City fans are going to be very interested in seeing the answers to. Lionel Messi, as you mentioned, Inter Miami not making the playoffs. What's he going to be spending his next 4 months doing, Paul?
Well, you can look at it as a positive or a negative if you're Lionel Messi about your time coming to the United States. They have the longest offseason in the world in Major League Soccer, especially if you don't make the playoffs, as is the case for Inter Miami. So they'll be off for all of November, all of December, start preseason in January, and don't play their next game until February. That's some time in between competitive matches. And it presents a little bit of a conundrum for Lionel Messi as he works his way back into the Argentinian national team. He's down with Argentina now, preparing for World Cup qualifiers in the next few days. Well, they also have World Cup qualifiers in November. So I think the short-term concern for Lionel Messi is how is he going to stay fit? How is he going to keep his form ahead of those qualifiers in November, including a massive qualifier against Brazil? After that, I expect that Messi will take a few weeks off, relax a little bit, and then come back to Miami in January, rested and fit and ready to kind of conquer Major League Soccer again. What will be interesting to see is how much does Miami change the roster around Messi. They made a lot of moves when they first signed him, bringing Busquets, bringing Alba, signing three young players from South America. Will Tata Martino put more of his imprint on the team in this offseason when Messi is coming back? But certainly this will be an offseason unlike any, I think, Messi has experienced before, just simply because he'll have so much time off. And I wonder how that'll impact his play and his fitness as he kind of is entering the final phase of his career to suddenly now have to adapt to several months between games.
They miss out on the playoffs. They did, though, win their first ever trophy, courtesy of Leo Messi's 10 goals in seven games, the inaugural League's Cup. How is his stint there being judged? And also, what's the reaction been like to the extraordinary rise in the season ticket prices for next season that Inter Miami have instituted? There were some amazing charts on The Athletic. I was trying to work out from it. It seemed like the cheapest one was more or less competitive with kind of really top-level ones around the top European clubs.
You know, this is a team that didn't have a ton of fans in their stadium in prior years when they were near the bottom of the conference and didn't have Lionel Messi on the field. So if there was going to be blowback, I think it's also to a certain degree understandable that there would be an increase considering the amount of money that's been invested in the roster and to have Messi on the team.
But they've doubled them, though, haven't they?
Yeah, that being said, yeah, to jump as much as they have at the stadium in which they play is a lot harder to justify. And as you mentioned, I think it's more difficult to equate the American League to the European leagues because MLS is so much more dependent on ticket revenue in order to drive profit or to drive revenue than European leagues, which have these massive media deals. MLS did sign a new deal with Apple, $250 million a year, but it's below what the European leagues make. And when I went to Dallas, it was Lionel Messi's first road trip. And, you know, that's a stadium that doesn't have a lot of those premier suite type tickets. A lot of it was just kind of the rank and file. And in the day of the game, I remember going out on the secondary market, looking at ticket prices and seeing seats for sale for $800, $900, $1,000 a piece. And, you know, if you looked at the next game that FC Dallas was playing, you get those same tickets for $5 or $10. So, you know, that gives you an idea of the kind of demand that Messi brought. And understandably so, it's the first chance for some of these fans to see him up close. The problem is going to be, again, how much longer can you do this? How much more can you ask of the fans? How much longer can you continue to increase ticket prices as a justification for a need to drive more revenue instead of maybe taking a look at the bigger problem, saying, okay, what do we need to do to increase our audiences to then increase our media deal? And I think that's kind of the conundrum that MLS faces now. It's like they need to solve the equation here and start to drive more revenue outside of just ticket sales.
And just briefly, was Messi making those playoffs? Was that part of their gamble in bringing him in?
Yeah, it would have been just kind of an added piece of this magic Messi moment of him coming to the United States, as you said earlier, 10 goals in seven games, winning a trophy right away. When he arrived, Miami was in last place in the Eastern Conference. They had a massive hole to dig out of, but MLS had just expanded their playoffs. And so 18 of the 29 teams were making the playoffs. So it was doable for Messi and Miami to get there. And I think, yes, it would have been a huge boon for Major League Soccer. I got myself in a bit of trouble writing a column saying that it was a missed opportunity for MLS that Messi missed the playoffs. I wasn't saying that MLS should have done what they could to rig games to get Messi. I was just saying that had Messi been in the playoffs, it would have brought this new audience that Messi attracts to the league. And the MLS playoffs are actually probably the best of the product that you'll see because they're these do or die knockout games. And it would have exposed that new audience to this product, to the best selling part of Major League Soccer, which is the playoffs. So to miss that moment, I think for me, it exacerbated, again, this debate happening behind the scenes. How do we take advantage of Messi? And I think it showed you have this finite window of time where Messi is going to be present in your league. What do you do to leverage that? You miss out now on these first playoffs. What are we going to do to grow the league around this audience that Messi is bringing? And MLS is going to have to answer that question now.
Okay. When do the playoffs start, Paul?
They start in just a couple weeks. So after we get back from the international break, MLS will play its decision day, the final day of the regular season, to determine those playoff seeds. And just a few days after that, MLS playoffs will start. So it'll be in early November.
And one player with Messi absent that we really have to keep an eye on for those playoffs?
I would have to say Lucho Acosta, another Argentine playmaker with Cincinnati, which won the Supporter Shield this year. He's been brilliant in his second round in Major League Soccer. I think some fans may remember the goal that Wayne Rooney set up where he chased a player back, won the ball, and hit that long diagonal to the small, diminutive little midfielder who headed it in. That was Lucho Acosta in D.C. He ended up leaving MLS, going down to Mexico, playing there for a couple years, and was brought back to Cincinnati, and he's been brilliant so far this season. So he's a player to keep an eye on.
Paul Tenorio. And you can read that piece, actually, about it's very interesting about where Messi missing out on the playoffs impacts MLS. On The Athletic, of course. Playoffs getting underway very, very soon, so hopefully we'll be speaking to Paul about that in the next week or two. For now, though, that brings us to the end of today's Totally Football Show. As I mentioned, on Monday, we'll be up a little bit later so we can include the exciting Sunday night action. Do make sure you hang around and join us for that. For now, it's many, many thanks to Dom Fifield, to Adrian Clark, and to Duncan Alexander, and Charlie and Rachel in the booth. And you, listener, and you, have a great weekend. Enjoy all that international football, and we'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.